Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Ladies and gentlemen, let me take you back now 30 years to 1989. In fact, I heard at my table when Peter Ryan from the ABC was married, and that's the time when Gerard Henderson founded the Sydney Institute as the forum for public debate and policy discussion. Now, some of you will remember that time well. Bob Hawke was our 23rd Prime Minister. Australia was handing back the Katherine Gorge to the traditional owners, the Jawoyn people. APEC had its first meeting in Canberra. And much darker, we had an earthquake which caused much devastation in Newcastle. There were pro-democracy rallies in China. The Berlin Wall came down. Solidarity won the Polish elections. Bush and Gorbachev met to discuss the end of the Cold War. Now, culturally, I'm sure you'll all remember that the Fine Young Cannibals, Madonna, Cher, and the Bangles were top of the popular music charts. The Simpsons first aired on telly, the web started, and the first GPS was fired into space. Batman, Twins, Ghostbusters, and Back to the Future were the top movies. And on that theme, in May 1989, tonight's guest, John Howard, our 25th Prime Minister, famously said, I'm sure you'll all remember it, that any return to his party's leadership would be like Lazarus with a triple bypass. Now, he didn't need that. In medical form, that is. But just a few months later, in August 1989, Gerard Henderson, Mr. Howard's former chief of staff, founded the Sydney Institute, and he's been our executive director, I'm pleased to say, ever since. So those of you who attend these events know that Gerard runs a very tight ship, and I can see him tapping his foot and tapping his phone, his watch right now. So he rarely speaks at these annual dinners, and I'm thrilled that in our 30th anniversary, that's all about to change. And I'm going to welcome Gerard to introduce John Howard.
Well, many thanks, Jacqueline, and it's great to be here. Look, we don't do mistakes at the Sydney Institute, but we do deliberate mistakes modelled on John Laws's, and we have the former Prime Minister down as the member for Barara rather than the former member for Ben Long, but it's a deliberate mistake and he was the one who picked it, as you might expect. Now, the Honourable John Howard, OMAC, needs no introduction. He's one of the best-known Australians. So tonight I'll use the opportunity to talk about the Sydney Institute in our 30th year before I talk about John Howard in his 80th year. First up, I want to thank my chair, Jacqueline Wilcox, and her predecessors, especially Nick Johnson, who's here tonight, who's just stepped down as our chairman, my other board members and their predecessors, along with our members and corporate supporters, and our present and former staff. One of them is here tonight, a good friend of mine, John Conkle, who ended up as Chief of Staff to the Prime Minister. The Sydney Institute has developed a great sense of camaraderie, which is evident when Joshua and Michelle Berger take us out on take the Institute family out at least once a year around Sydney Harbour in their yacht, the MY Tango. I should also thank Sky News, which films our public talks, which makes it possible for many of our supporters outside of Sydney, along with many of our supporters, with young supporters with family commitments, to follow our program on television. Now, I first met John Howard, as Jacqueline implied, in the early 1980s when I was employed in the public service, the Commonwealth Public Service in Melbourne, and he was treasurer in Malcolm Fraser's government. Now, I was not a natural public servant, and my managers decided that I needed a morale boost and sent me off a training session which was expected to lead to greater assertiveness in my work environment. And one afternoon in late 1983, just after returning from one of these morale-boosting sessions, the phone rang and a voice said, "Gerard, would you like to work for me?" And seizing the moment, I replied, "Yes, who's calling?" And so it came to pass that I worked for John Howard in 1984, 1985, and 1986, when he was Deputy Leader of the Opposition and later Leader of the Opposition. I learned much from my time on Mr. Howard's staff. I was much impressed by his reliability and punctuality and his scrupulous honesty in handling his parliamentary entitlements. And of course, then as now, John Howard believed in many causes, including the importance of economic reform. Also, he was a hard worker and a great family man. I got to know Jeanette Howard on a visit to China in 1985. In Shanghai, we stayed in an historical hotel in the old quarter. After being shown to our rooms, I found that I had to share accommodation with a large rat. I went and knocked on the Howards' door and advised them of my plight. Whereupon Jeanette said, "I can handle this." She marched to my room, yelled and stomped on the floor. The rodent disappeared, not to return. As a man who admires strong women, I was mightily impressed, I have to say. At the end of 1986, I received a call from Sydney businessman Jim Bain, who asked me to take over an old organisation in Sydney with a view to reviving it. Jim and Jeanette Bain made a very generous personal financial contribution for over 3 years, and without Jim's role, we would not be here tonight. Following early successes, in 1989, we closed down the organisation, the old organisation, and established the Sydney Institute, and we formally launched it in August with the then Premier Nick Greiner and the then opposition leader Bob Carr as guest speakers. Towards the end of 1989, Leda Mathias joined the Institute as our executive assistant. She had just arrived with her family on a plane from Bombay, now Mumbai, 4 days before. Early in the interview, I asked what I thought was a pretty tough question, which is, who's the Premier of New South Wales? She replied, Nick Greiner. She got the job. That was very impressive, and she started the next day, and she's still with us. Now, from day one, we had a gender and political balance in our program, as the slide presentation tonight demonstrates. Kim Beazley was the first to give a public talk, followed by a private dinner for our corporate supporters. When in government and opposition, Kim said publicly how valuable the Institute was in providing a platform to both sides of mainstream politics. Gareth Evans made a similar comment, as has John Howard and many others. And I should also mention in passing that Gladys Berejiklian first addressed the Institute in October 1997. One afternoon at 41 Phillip Street, during the time of the Howard government, the doorbell rang on the ground floor and a voice said, "I want to speak to Gerard." I was upstairs and I replied, "Who is it?" And the person responded, "Let me in." And so it went on for a while, and eventually I surrendered. And I pressed the door release button and heard footsteps on the tiles below. And then the voice said, "It's Paul Keating here." Whereupon I replied, "Sorry, Paul, I thought you were some kind of a nutter." To which Paul replied, "Mate, I am some kind of a nutter." In a recent discussion with Aaron, I remarked at my surprise that when working with John Howard about how polite and helpful he was to the men and women in the parliamentary press gallery who were frequently so critical of him every morning, every night, and frequently during the day. And Anne's response was, "Well, John became the second longest serving Prime Minister in Australia, and you ended up a mere scribbler." And speaking as a scribbler and as a historian, I regard in chronological order Robert Menzies, Bob Hawke, and John Howard as Australia's greatest Prime Ministers in the modern era. They compare well with the most successful leaders of Britain and the United States in the same time frame. John Howard's great strength is that, agree with him or not, there is no doubt about where he stands on the key national and international issues of our time. Moreover, I have always admired his enormous personal courage in advocating at times unpopular and unfashionable causes when the easiest thing to do would be to say or write nothing. So tonight, I am honoured to invite Mr. Howard to speak to us on the topic, "Has politics really changed from Menzies to Morrison?" Thank you.
Good. Thank you. Thank you, Jared. You haven't lost your touch. You're very, very good. Can I start by saying I am really honoured that Jared and Anne Henderson and the Sydney Institute have asked me to give this speech tonight. And it's a wonderful gathering of people, not only from the marvellous city of Sydney, but around the nation. But there is one person I want to especially single out tonight, and that is the re-elected Premier of New South Wales. I still have a lot of faith in the political process of this country, and I've long believed that there are two things that will ultimately be rewarded by the Australian people. And those two things are integrity and competence, and you, Gladys, have both of them in spades. I also, of course, as Jared has done, acknowledge the former premiers of New South Wales who are here tonight, and also my friend, the former Prime Minister of Australia, Tony Abbott. Tony, as you know, leading a political party is not easy. Anybody who's had that experience will testify to it. And there's a special place in the pantheon of any political party for those who've led that party from opposition back into government. And as you know, in the history of the party to which you and I, Tony, belong, there are only four people done that: Menzies, Fraser, Howard and Abbott. But tonight is also an occasion to celebrate the contribution of the Sydney Institute to the public life, not only of Sydney, but also of Australia. In reflecting on my topic tonight, I instantaneously came to the conclusion that more than anything else, politics is a contest of ideas. It's not a public relations tournament. It's not just a talk fest, although there's a lot of talk involved in politics. But fundamentally, it is a contest of ideas. And that is why an organisation like the Sydney Institute is so enormously important, because it's been a forum, and may I say a very balanced and bipartisan forum, for people interested in political ideas and the contest of those ideas. And over the years, and we were reminded of it tonight with the display of photographs, the Institute has provided platforms for people, famous people from abroad, such as Dubček, for others who've come from our own localities to engage in that great contest of ideas. And I congratulate Jared, you and Anne, and all the team at the Sydney Institute for the way in which you have been a standard bearer for the contest of political ideas. I was thinking tonight of how I could best encapsulate some of the changes that have occurred in Australian politics between Menzies and Morrison, and somebody rather wittily said to me he didn't really think Menzies could spell the word Twitter. And I think fundamentally that is probably as good a description as any to pinpoint some of the changes that undoubtedly have occurred. And there are many of them. Probably the greatest change that has occurred is the geostrategic and geopolitical environment in which our country exists. When Menzies was Prime Minister, politics around the world, and certainly in Australia, internationally speaking, was dominated by the Cold War. Cold War between the West, led by the United States, and Soviet imperialism, dominated not only the countries of Eastern Europe and other parts of the world, but also the politics of our own nation. The most momentous domestic political event of that era, the great split in the Australian Labor Party in the 1950s, was a direct product of the impact of the Cold War on Australian politics. Now, in the years that have gone by since Menzies left us at the beginning of 1966, That environment has changed. We've seen the collapse of Soviet imperialism and we've seen the extraordinary rise of China. China was an ideological threat and a distant country that we didn't really understand in the 1950s and 1960s. Now, of course, China is our best customer. And the strength of Chinese demand for Australian resources was one of the reasons why we dodged the real bullet of the global financial downturn more than 10 years ago. The other great changes that have occurred involve the structure of our political system. Political parties in Australia now are no longer anything resembling what they were in the 40s and 50s, and that is mass movements of the population. Membership of political parties is smaller, and all political parties are, how shall I put it, fracturing at the edges. When I was first growing up in politics in Australia in the 1950s, I operated under what I called the 40-40-20 rule. 40% always voted Liberal, 40% voted Labor, and 20% moved around in the middle. Now I often feel that it's a 30-30-40 system because the committed support of the parties has reduced. Let me give you an illustration. The Australian Labor Party reached its nadir in the 1960s at the 1966 election, but the primary vote of the Labor Party in that election was still 40%. Yet in the recent state election in New South Wales, it was down to 33%, and it's been at that level in some previous federal elections. And I could say the same thing about the support base of the party, which I'm still proud to belong to. Political parties now are far less representative of the people in the community who vote for them. The base of political parties is not only numerically smaller, but the membership, I think, is less representative of the community than it used to be. We've seen some internal structural changes in the makeup of our political system. The career path of a political staffer didn't exist in 1974, when I was elected to federal parliament. Every federal member of parliament had one staffer who was essentially an electorate secretary, who was a skilled stenographer, and I was somebody who experienced that kind of support, but just one person. Since then, of course, so much of that has changed. The background, the occupational background of many of the cabinets now are very different from what they were years ago. It may surprise many people to know that the last Chifley cabinet, which of course was defeated at the election of 1949, a long, long time ago, that cabinet of course included many people such as the then Prime Minister, Ben Chifley, who'd had a very proud trade union background. But that cabinet also included five farmers, one dentist, two lawyers and one tobacconist. Now that's practically a criminal offence these days. By contrast, the Gillard government had no farmers. It had predominant background of former party officials or union officials that had two lawyers, one teacher, one diplomat, but conspicuously no person who'd had any kind of business experience. And whilst the data would be different, the same kind of observations could be made about the composition of different cabinets and different ministries on the coalition side of politics. So a great many things have changed, but of course there are some things that have remained absolutely constant. And the most important of those is what I said at the beginning of my speech, and that is politics is fundamentally a contest of values and ideas. I learnt that very early in my political life, that in the end, if you stand for something consistently, even though you may not win every argument and certainly may not win every election, you will ultimately win the respect and the support of the Australian community. There's something else, of course, about Australian politics that has not changed over the period from Menzies to Morrison. And I was reminded of that when I was reflecting on the first ever meeting I had way back in 1979 when I went to the United States as Treasurer. And I met Dr. Alan Greenspan. He was then Chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers in the Carter administration, having been appointed to that position by President Ford. And he shook my hand and he says, "Ah, Mr. Howard," he said, "you're from Australia, aren't you? You've got the biggest middle class in the world." And then we started to have a conversation about the middle class in the United States and the middle class in Australia. And it was something, a thought that stayed with me ever since. And of course, it is so true about our country. There are many things that are part of what I call the Australian achievement. And one of those is that through a combination of policy to which both sides of politics at various stages have made a contribution, we have built, indeed, proportionately the largest middle class of any developed country in the world. And this was endorsed only a few months ago by an analysis produced by Credit Suisse, which looked at the various economies of the world, and it concluded just how middle-class Australia really was. Median wealth per adult, Australia was first place, just ahead of Switzerland. Only 6% of people in Australia have wealth per capita below $10,000 versus 18% in the United Kingdom and 28% in the United States. Now, those two figures drive home very strongly just how middle class this country is. And that is its most enduring economic and social strength. If there's one thing that I would plead with all those involved in Australian politics at the present time to do, and that is to hang on for dear life with our middle class character as a nation. Because it is something to which all of us instinctively aspire. One of the great things that this country has done has been to build that middle class. It was a legacy of the Menzies government, and contributions have been made to it by successive governments. We often hear our welfare system derided, and I'm sure our welfare system does have a lot of faults, but it also has an enormous strength. I think in many ways Australia has found the sweet spot when it comes to a balanced welfare system. We don't have the harshness of the American laissez-faire approach. The state of the United States that my wife and I have visited a lot in recent years is Texas, because one of our children lived there for an extended period of time. It's a wonderful state, and it's got some wonderful people, and it produced a wonderful president who remains a very close friend of mine. But it's a state that has a huge prison population, and a population in jail way above proportionately the same prison population in Australia, which has roughly the same population as Texas. I think one of the flaws of the American social welfare system is that it is a little too harsh, and it does push people unavoidably into crime. By contrast, of course, the European system is far too paternalistic, and it's far too difficult to change. And yet, in between those two extremes, Australia has found, over the years, a balance. And in so doing, we have once again demonstrated another great strength of our country, and something that we should be very proud of as part of the Australian achievement. And that is that this nation has an enormous sense of balance. We don't have endless debates in this country in the way they occur in many other developed countries about the respective roles of the public and private sectors in areas such as health and education. We have 34% of Australian students educated in independent schools, and they operate side by side with a public education system that underpins the basic provision of education, irrespective of people's incomes, all over our various states. We have a health system which, for all its flaws, and heavens, every health system has got flaws, is a very balanced one. It's a balance of the public and the private. And this reflects the capacity that this country has had for generations, and that is to achieve a great sense of balance through a common sense application of our challenges. I think of our nation's British inheritance, and we owe much to the British for the country that we have. But the good thing about our British inheritance is that we took the good things and we rejected the bad things. We took the freedom of the press, we took parliamentary democracy, we took the rule of law, we took, by and large, the sense of humour, but we rejected the class distinctions and the aristocracy and the obsession with people's backgrounds, and we, as a nation, collectively decided to judge people on their basic individual worth and the contribution that they were willing to make to our society. Now, if all of that may... Now, if all of that may sound like some kind of paean of praise for our nation, well, it is. So I think one of our failings, and we have many failings, is that we are too ready to accept a denigration of our past, that we are too ready to misstate or understate the contribution that this country has made in so many endeavours. It still astonishes me, and I still address various audiences from time to time, it still astonishes me how few Australians understand that the secret ballot was pioneered in this country. How few Australians understand that women in Australia had equal franchise and equal participation in elections decades ahead of women in the United Kingdom, the United States, or many other countries around the world. These are basic achievements, but our understanding and comprehension of them is very, very poor indeed. So when I reflect on things that we have done well and things that we have done badly, and how much our country has changed since the days of Robert Gordon Menzies as Prime Minister, I must also reflect on those areas where things have remained the same. There is still a fundamental respect in this country for our institutions, but we should keep that respect in good repair. We should not take it for granted that our institutions will always maintain that continuity of respect. And we must work hard at reminding all of our citizens of the contributions that have been made to democracy around the world by we here in Australia. The political parties that now occupy the Australian political stage, they still fundamentally are two great constellations of the left centred around the Australian Labor Party and the constellation of the centre-right centred around the Liberal Party and the National Party. Both of them need to understand that complacency does not have any kind of reward. And any assumption that support is automatic and continuous and without challenge as the years go by will be doomed to political failure and public rebuke. And what we are witnessing at the present time is an assault on the supremacy of both of those parties. And there is fracturing at the edges. Now, I'm not an apostle of gloom in that area. In fact, I remain very much of the view that those two constellations will remain dominant in Australian politics for years into the future. But for that to be realised, and naturally I look at it from the point of view of my own side of politics, we need to reassert the primacy of values and the primacy of ideas. And we need to understand that all major successful political parties are in some way either formal coalitions, such as we have between the Liberal Party and the National Party, or collections of people with varied views. I've often described my own political party, the Liberal Party, as being the broad church of people of classical liberal intent and a conservative bent. That doesn't mean to say they're neatly divided into two identifiable groups, but what it means is that on most issues, people are a mixture of the two. I've reflected on my own political career. I think of some of the, I might say, mildly conservative stances I've taken. And I also think, of course, of some of the more liberal, classical liberal stances that I've taken. Gerard will be aware of the long commitment I've had to labour market reform and the freeing of the industrial relations system in Australia. I see that very much as being an exercise in classical liberalism, the elevation of the role of the individual in the workplace. And of course, the march of history is still in favour of that. It's interesting to reflect that when Bob Menzies ceased being Prime Minister of Australia, 64% of all Australians in the workforce belong to a trade union. That figure is now only 15%, of which 10% are to be found in the private sector. Yet paradoxically enough, the existing industrial relations system of this country affords a greater role of the trade union movement than it did some 15 or 20 years ago. But it's a reminder to all political parties that allegiance is not something that can ever be taken for granted. And if I have a criticism of public discourse at the present time, is that it has lapsed too readily into the belief that it can all be solved by slogans. And when we think of changes that have occurred in the Australian community and which affect politics in a superficial way, none has been more dominant, of course, than the change in the role of media. When I left politics, or shall I put it more honestly, when politics asked me to leave, in 2007, there was no Facebook, there was no Twitter. I thought YouTube was very exciting when with the assistance of people like David Luff, who's here tonight, placed material on YouTube. But I think social media has had an enormous impact. But we shouldn't allow it to have a permanent impact. We shouldn't allow it to rob us of a capacity to engage in civilised discourse. I still believe that the Australian people will listen to an argument in favour of economic reform. And as somebody who's been involved in debates on economic reform for many years, both in responding to sensible reforms proposed by a government that I opposed in my years in opposition, but also reforms that my government advocated, I think the Australian public will listen to reform provided two conditions are satisfied. They've got to be satisfied that it's good for Australia, because at heart Australians do care about the collective welfare of their country. And they've also got to be satisfied that the less fortunate, the vulnerable in the community will be carefully looked after. And I think in the end, one of the reasons why the most difficult of the economic reforms in which I was involved, and that was the introduction of the GST, why ultimately we won that argument. And that is because those two conditions have been satisfied. The people in the end accepted, albeit grudgingly on the part of many, that we needed that tax reform, and they were satisfied that the provisions made for the vulnerable were adequate. So let me say to all of you tonight, as we gather to honour an institution which has made a contribution to sensible, reasoned economic, political and cultural debate, that the Australian people remain not only optimistic, but they remain open to persuasion if you can make your case. You won't win the argument by shouting, you won't win the argument by slogans. You won't win the argument by bigotry or prejudice. And you won't win the argument trying to persuade fundamentally a middle-class community that inequality is rising, because inequality in Australia is not rising, the middle-class character of the country has been retained. You won't win those sort of arguments with that sort of excessive rhetoric. But you can win an argument based on values. You can win an argument which appeals to the patriotism of the Australian community. And you can win an argument if you satisfy the Australian community that the policy you are arguing for is one that is going to look after the more vulnerable in our community. Jared, to you and Anne and the members of the Sydney Institute, thank you for the contribution that you have made to sensible, reasoned debate in our country. There's nothing more exciting in public life than to feel that you've been involved in an argument and in a debate. It's really terrific if you won the argument and the debate, but it is fundamentally satisfying if you can at least say to yourself that you've had the opportunity of putting the argument, that it's been a genuine contest of ideas, and the Australian public have made a reasoned decision and a reasoned conclusion. And you in the Sydney Institute should be very proud of the contribution that you have made to that process over the last 30 years. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Howard. I'd now like to invite Carmel Mulhern from Telstra and also the Sydney Institute Board to propose the vote of thanks.
Good evening, everyone. It is my great pleasure to offer a vote of thanks to the former Prime Minister of Australia, the Honourable Mr. John Howard, for his fascinating remarks and insights this evening. And it seems only fitting that in the 30th year since the Sydney Institute was founded by Gerard Henderson back in 1989, that our keynote speaker is Australia's second longest serving Prime Minister, who himself is in his 80th year. At this dinner last year, I can recall commending Mr. Howard on his engaging introduction to last year's speaker, the then and still Premier of New South Wales, the Honourable Gladys Berejiklian, which he delivered without a single speaking note. And Mr. Howard's response was, "Well, I hope I learned a few things after all those years in politics." And clearly you did, Mr. Howard. Thank you for sharing your reflections on the changing politics in this country since the time of Sir Robert Menzies back in 1939. When I saw the topic for tonight's speech, "Has Politics Changed? Menzies to Morrison," I really was curious to know what Mr. Howard's answer would be. Has politics changed in the last 80 years? Will we ever see another Prime Minister serve more than 10-year term? Would someone with a long surname and a woman have been elected Premier of New South Wales in 1939 or in 1989? Is the rise of populism and short-termism new, or was it always there? And have the current societal and economic issues and drivers of the politics and the policy changed, or have they not really changed that much at all? And tonight we've heard a number of things that have changed, and a number of things that haven't. What has changed? The geopolitical environment in which we exist has changed, and Mr. Howard talked about the impact of the Cold War, the rise of China, and the changes that have happened there. The changes in our political structures with the fracturing of parties at the edges, the growing number of people who move, electors who move, and he talked about the 30, 30, 40. And he talked about the changing composition of cabinet, the changing role of business people in cabinet, the changing role of tobacconists in cabinet. Mr. Howard, listening to you this evening caused me to reflect on the role and nature of leadership, particularly political leadership, and how trust really is at the heart of it. And as you said, what makes truly great leaders sit so powerfully in our national psyche is integrity and competence. We've also heard tonight what hasn't changed and what we don't want to change. Our enduring and economic strength, that middle class character of our nation, our balance as a nation, we don't want any of that to change. But Mr. Howard did lament the fact that we are too ready to denigrate our past, and that is something that we shouldn't do. He called for us to reassert the primacy of ideas and not solve issues by slogans. I think the point that was really impactful for me is those last comments, Mr. Howard, about winning the argument based on values and appealing to patriotism and having a policy where you look after the vulnerable in our community. That is something that hasn't changed. And another thing that hasn't changed is the responsibilities our politicians bear, the wisdom they carry, and the fact that the policies that they develop touch the lives of all of us. Mr. Howard, again, we are very, very grateful for your remarks this evening. I'm sure you have prompted a lot of thinking and debate. Thank you to the Sydney Institute, and particularly Jared and Anne Henderson, for organising what is always an important annual event and an opportunity for us all to come together and to share and to debate and discuss topics so relevant, particularly with the federal election only a couple of months away. So thank you from all of us here this evening, Mr. Howard. You have made this a very special occasion on our 30th anniversary, and can you all please join me in thanking the former Prime Minister of Australia, Mr. John Howard.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.